All right, well, good afternoon, everybody. As always, you're listening to the ASSP Healthcare Practice Specialties Health Beat podcast, and also simultaneously listening to the Association for Occupational Health Professionals in Healthcare, Caring for Healthcare Professionals podcast. So we appreciate everybody joining us as always. It's always great to quote unquote see everybody, and we hope you find everything helpful and informative. So today we got a fantastic guest. Today we're talking to Vaughn Baker. He's with Strategos, and they've done a fantastic amount of work in the area of workplace violence / active shooter prevention, response, recovery, all different things in that area, in addition to a lot of other great work. So we were fortunate to have him on a webinar a couple months ago, both with ASSP and AOHP. And what we found really informative was that their presentation, it has a lot of information in there that we don't normally see in a lot of cases. So there's a lot of things they were talking about, like normalcy bias and things of that nature, that are just really interesting and informative. And they do a lot to educate and provide a basis for response on these kind of terrible situations that tragically have continued to happen even up to a couple of days ago. So it's just horrifying that that's the way it is. And it's good that they're doing so much work to educate and train people to be able to respond to that. So we're going to get into it and talk about that kind of work that they're doing. Vaughn, I don't want to speak for you though. So if you can give our listeners a little bit about yourself, you know, your background, experience, education, anything that you want to put out there, we appreciate it.
Absolutely, Corey. It's great to be with you all, and thank you for having us on. And as you said, there is a tremendous need, and I wish there wasn't a tremendous need for this sort of education. But we can do a lot to not only prevent, but also effectively respond to these. So a little bit about my background experience. Spent over 20 years in law enforcement, both in special operations and investigations realm. And since that time, I have left law enforcement on a full-time basis. And since 2002, we have been serving corporate government, over 300,000 folks, faith-based law enforcement, military, and academic fields and healthcare fields on this type of topic, security-related topics, active threat, and behavior threat analysis as well. I've also written a couple books. One of them is called Active Threat Workplace 911, and it educates people how to prepare, and another one on faith-based and church security as well. So I have a couple certifications in behavior threat analysis where we serve our clients in that way, but we love to work with clients before the incident occurs. Although many times we find ourselves working with clients after the incident occurs. So it's just what we're passionate about. And you know, a cardiologist doesn't hope for people to have heart attacks, but when somebody does have a cardiac emergency, they're glad somebody knows what they're doing. And that's kind of the role we're trying to fill.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's great. And like you said, there's definitely a need for it. Sadly, that's a great extension, you know, that you've gone from tactical law enforcement into what you do now. It's definitely gives you the credibility, you know, the validity, and of course the experience. So we're going to kind of get into it from the beginning, you know, with anything with hazards and threats. You know, we always talk about the initial analysis and how they come about, and then more importantly, what we can do about it. So first things first, you know, in your experience and your research and all the years you've been doing this work, how do these situations come about? I know that's a thing a lot of people are just, I would say baffled, but that almost is putting it too lightly. You know, people have a really hard time getting their hands and their minds around how somebody could decide to just mercilessly murder people. You know, it's horrifying. So what are your thoughts on that? How do these things come about?
Yeah, Corey, that's a great question. And sometimes you'll hear the phrase used by some people post-incident where they'll say, oh, he just snapped one day. And but when you really analyze these incidents, you will see that there's days, weeks, months of behavior indicators prior to the attack occurring, where if people would have been educated on what to look for, and then of course educated the importance of reporting that information, there would be many opportunities to intervene and de-escalate that risk and that threat if they simply knew what to look for. We know this, almost all bad acts are preceded by bad behavior, and negative behavior or behavior that's concerning to others. So if we can educate people what to look for behaviorally, then that will really give us an increased opportunity and opportunities to prevent the incident from occurring altogether.
Definitely. Yeah, that's similar. I almost hate to make the comparison because they're just so different. But, you know, if you're thinking about a situation where there's a workplace incident, same type of thing we usually see is that there's typically, you know, a pattern of whether it's unsafe conditions or unsafe work practices, or there's no work practices defined, you know, people are just kind of guessing, or they don't have the right PPE or whatnot. And to your point, you know, it's very rarely a singular incident where it's that kind of freak accident, so to speak. It's usually a pattern that leads up to it. So that definitely makes sense. What you're saying is, you know, there's a history of these types of behaviors or precedents being set for it.
So yeah, we usually don't see a singular indicator other than a direct threat indicating that we have a problem. Usually what we see is clusters of behavior changes. And that's where, as you analyze those clusters of behavior changes, especially somebody that knows how to analyze those and measure them and assign a score to them, now that will allow you to determine what kind of risk you're dealing with, whether that's low, medium, or high, or very high risk.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. The risk assessment is huge. So that's kind of the next thing I was going to ask about, actually, is you had mentioned those kind of patterns and those types of maybe negative behaviors or at least concerning behaviors. What are some examples of that? What are some types of indicators that you might see?
Well, we typically, when we do an assessment, we'll look at different types of behavioral indicators. And some of those would be, and some of this information, maybe only a certain stakeholder group would have information about. What I mean by that is, of course, the coworkers will have opportunities to observe certain types of behaviors. Other types of indicators would be, is that person under financial duress? Have they gone through some civil judgments for inability to pay their bills? Have they gone through bankruptcy? That's added duress. Have they gone through other court proceedings? Maybe they just went through a divorce, lost custody of a child. Some of those pieces of information are difficult to know by the coworker. So as people in leadership, now we have to, if we do start to get some indicators of people being concerned, now we got to go on search in the other domain group areas and see what other information we can gather to determine, are there some other indicators present? Some other examples of that would be, obviously, the obvious ones, have they made specific threats, but maybe veiled threats, or have they positioned themselves showing empathy with other attackers of other incidents, where they might make a statement like, after an incident somewhere that's occurred that made the national news, they might say, man, I hate that happened, but I can see what would drive somebody to do something like that. And now they're showing empathy with the attacker. So all of those types of things, do they have a recent fascination of weapons? Maybe they're starting, all of a sudden, they're starting to pose with handguns or long guns on their Facebook page, and or posting videos of them shooting at the range. And in a few cases in the past, they've actually put targets on the ground, paper targets, where they practice shooting targets on the ground. And what they're doing is practicing shooting people that will be on the ground and how they play in the attack. So all those things add up to paint a picture. And that's what we got to look for and gather information in regards.
Definitely. Yeah, it's really, you know, quite scary to think about that would go through somebody's mind, you know, that they feel that, you know, disenfranchised, that they would purposefully plan to just execute people. It's really quite terrifying. it's almost, you know, a lot of times people use that phrase almost kind of lightheartedly, where they say, you know, somebody's playing the victim or whatnot. It's interesting how that, what I kind of gather from what you're saying is that there's these people that they feel in their mind, whether it's legitimate or not, they feel like they've been victimized. And so they're going to kind of turn the script by becoming the worst possible offender there could be. Yeah.
Well, and that worldview that you're talking about there, Corey, is what one of the other things we look for. Do they have a victimizer mindset? Mm. And many of the times what happens is these people have a long list of personal failures, and the last person they blame for their failures is themselves. It's always got to be somebody else's fault. And what they're trying to do is they see the victim category as the category of failure, and that's kind of where they've seen themselves. And they see the victimizer category as the category of success. So their worldview is they're trying to transition from that victim category to the victimizer category, because they see that victimizer category is to them, that's winning.
Mm. Yeah, that's a scary thing to unfold. So, yes. So like we were saying with, you know, with anything in safety, of course, we want to know how the situations happen and what to look for, how to increase the situational awareness. And then of course comes the big ultimate question is, you know, what can we do about it? So if we're talking about safety, of course, you've got, you know, pretty defined regulations in a lot of cases. You've got the Code of Federal Regulations, or you've got national consensus standards, or you know, organizational policies or things of that nature. But in this case, are there any kind of laws, regulations, guidance, and any things that people should be looking towards as far as minimal guidance standards?
Yeah, there's a few. I know recently, over the last few years, CMS for the healthcare field has outlined workplace violence preparedness directives, healthcare being one of the highest risks, because one in four nurses at some point in the last couple of years of their career have reported being a victim of an assault. So that it's gotten, because it usually is, healthcare is usually the second leading cause or incident frequency of workplace violence. That's what caused some of those regulations. One of the other regulations is OSHA's general duty clause. It's kind of a catch-all regulation where basically it says that the workplace is regulated, and they're required to provide a workplace free of recognizable hazards. But one of the ways that we really educate folks from a layperson's perspective on this idea of liability, which I think is what you're referring to in a more broad term sense, is what is, how do you evaluate and measure liability? Well, it's usually done based on one of asking and answering two questions. The first one is, can the need or should the need that you're trying to prepare for have been anticipated in advance? And if the answer to that question is yes, then the next question that needs to be asked, then how do we, or what have we done as an organization to prepare responsibly for that, to address that need? So that's really the two-step process for liability. Now, in regards to healthcare specifically, one of the other liability topics that comes up, especially when you're talking about the active threat preparedness, is this idea of patient abandonment. Mm-hmm. And you know, some of the response models for active threat that are being taught out there say it's the run, hide, fight model, and that means run away from the threat. Well, that's not realistic in the healthcare field, leaving patients behind. So, and in fact, that would really significantly expose the organization to liability if they did that, if all the employees just left their patients to fend for themselves that were vulnerable, and that they would result in, and I'm assuming, a large amount of health abandonment claims, healthcare abandonment claims.
Definitely, and that's really, really important that you bring that up. That's something that's really interesting, because I guess I have kind of a unique vantage point, I guess, is I work in healthcare, but then I also work in the public sector, and so I do hear it on both sides of that fence. You know, where you have the concern of patient abandonment, then you have the kind of the catch-all message, you know, run, hide, fight, or avoid, deny, defend, or, you know, the different acronyms that are being used. So that's important that you address that. I appreciate that. And that kind of brings us into the next thing. So in the case of safety, you know, we always go through the hierarchy of controls. You know, if we can eliminate the hazard or the threat all the way to the point of PPE. And so one of the things that's always been interesting in the case of elimination, if you're talking about hazard or threat elimination, is with any kind of hazard or threat that may come from another person, you know, in the case of healthcare, you've got things like disease exposures or bloodborne pathogens or things of that nature. The concept of hazard elimination is usually kind of null and void because you can't pick your patients. You know, you get who comes in. So one of the things that's been talked about a lot is the concept of this kind of strategic risk management, where we can hopefully eliminate these threats before they manifest. You know, so for example, if somebody, like you said, if somebody's making these kind of veiled threats, or they're being kind of conspicuous about it, or like you said, they say something to the effect of, you know, I bought 15 guns last weekend, you know, and I've been stockpiling ammunition or whatnot. There's that kind of wish, so to speak, that we could do this strategic risk assessment. So we'll say, well, that seems sketchy, so we're going to do a background check, and we're going to see what's going on. And we're gonna, if we find something, then we can deny this person access to the facility before they try to hurt somebody or whatnot. So when we talk about hazard elimination, that's usually the conversation that comes up, is this kind of long-term strategic assessment and trying to get the person out of the building before they become violent. What are your thoughts on that? Is that reasonable? Is that something that you've seen be successful?
Well, you know, that's the only way to eliminate risk is if you had absence of any kind of personal interactions and employee or client customer and organization interactions. And of course, that's not realistic in mm-hmm. any workplace. So when you talk about separating the employee from the organization, that in itself does not eliminate risk. And many people think it does. They say, well, this person's really crossed the line. It's time to terminate them. And they think, okay, now that we've terminated them and it went smooth, now the risk is over with. And not only have we worked with organizations where the attack has occurred days, weeks, months afterward, but and I can think of one example of organization we worked with where 4 years after the separation, the person was elevating risk and making statements on social media and things of that nature. So it is tough to eliminate the risk. So really, when I think what you're talking about as far as elimination is, hey, let's increase the opportunities to prevent these from occurring by educating people on what some of these indicators are, as well as, if God forbid it does occur, how do we effectively respond to prevent access to the attacker?
Definitely. Yeah, that's 4 years later, that's definitely a premeditated situation. Mm-hmm. That's scary. I know of one similar. It wasn't 4 years, but there was a former employee who had been employment terminated, and they had gone home and retrieved a firearm and came back, and it went from there. So it's terrible how that goes. So in those cases, you know, that, you know, that's a good way to try to, you know, get proactive about it, try to look for the mm-hmm. the risk in advance, definitely. And so that kind of brings us to the next thing, which is substitution. You know, of course, the classic example of substitution was, you know, when as a people, you know, we realized that benzene was a carcinogen, and so people stopped using benzene to clean tools and, you know, got solvents that weren't causing leukemia. So that's a classic, you know, substitution there. In the case of workplace violence, active shooter, a lot of times what we talk about would be facilities type substitution, where you have better access to egress points, or you have better access control, or you have better electronic surveillance or physical security or things of that nature. Are there any other examples, things that can be switched around that can make things safer?
Absolutely. And those are all great examples. One of the ways we do it through in our high-risk termination consulting services that we provide is we provide a very unique way of substitution. And in that case, what we do is we come in and we work with the person of interest to the employee that they're concerned about. And whether it's a union-based situation or non-union, we come in and we deliver, not only do we do the investigation, but we deliver the news to the employee that we, as the outside experts, have come in and done an investigation, determined that not only have they violated policy on multiple fronts, but we are now recommending that they be separated from the organization. So what we're doing in that case is now we're transferring that aggression that person may or may not have from the organization itself to us. So we are the substitute for that aggression and the reason that person may be perceiving that they lost their job is us. So that's another example of substitution that we do with organizations as well.
Yeah, that's great. That's a good service and a good way to, like you said, you know, provides a kind of a buffer for that hostility. So definitely. All right. That's awesome. Yeah. So that kind of brings it to the next thing there. So at this point, you know, if we can't remove the threat or the hazard, and we can't substitute something, then we go to engineering, you know, so we look for the opportunities to use some kind of barrier or mechanical, some way that we can design the situation to make it safer. So a lot of times in this case, you know, we'll talk about things like setting up, in healthcare in particular, you know, we'll talk about setting up the patient care room so that the workstation is not in the, you know, the back left corner, so the employee is not forced to go to the most inopportune position in the room. If the patient becomes violent, they're not trapped in the back corner. You know, making sure they have access to egress, things of that nature. Are there any other opportunities there as far as design?
Yeah, sure. What you're talking about there is physical security solutions. And, you know, if we're talking about a secure facility, and now we have people that have some sort of access control process to get into the facility, it's also important maybe to consider vehicle bollards. And that would prevent a vehicle from driving through the front door. I've seen multiple examples where that's occurred. That would be an engineering solution. Gunshot detection systems, where not only does that detect that a gunshot, technology is advanced now that not only will detect the caliber of the round, but it triangulates where that's coming from within the facility in an automated fashion, notifies local authorities, and it activates mass communication notifications for employees on the scene. So those two-way apps that organizations have, whether it's on an app or a piece of software, how do we communicate the crisis that's occurring to people in a very quick manner? Those are other examples of engineering controls.
That's great. Yeah, that's definitely been a big conversation we've had a lot of times is that, you know, if somebody has to get themselves in that vulnerable position, you know, where they don't have egress or they don't have communication or there's, you know, there's just basically a lot of vulnerabilities there. And it creates definitely a risk and a lack of peace of mind for those employees. So in those cases, the next step would be, you know, your administrative controls. And in a lot of times, the engineering kind of segues into that. So like you said, you know, if you've got your notification methods, your communication means like panic buttons, security as a deterrent, things of that nature, a lot of times those provide those types of process controls so that the sooner the threat can be identified, then it can be communicated to others and that person that's in that situation will be able to get out of there safely. What are your thoughts on process controls, things that people can use to identify indicators, call for support, take immediate action to mitigate harm? And any thoughts on those?
Yeah, there's three administrative controls that we usually recommend, and two of these three we don't see very often as within organizations where they already have something in place. The first one is establishing and defining what our high-risk termination policy is going to be and procedures are. And that means, first of all, what's the criteria? Is this a high-risk termination? And once we reach that criteria, what is the process going to be for how we conduct that termination? Not too many organizations have a policy like that in place. The second one would be on educating our employees in a policy on reporting when they're a victim of domestic violence. Many of these incidents reflect the reality that one in four women, for instance, at some point in their life report being a victim of domestic abuse. So with those kind of statistics, we need to educate our employees that if they're a victim of domestic violence, one, that they need to report that to their employer, and two, letting them know that we have employee assistance programs that will help them, give them resources to get help in those situations. And not only by reporting that information, are they going to keep themselves safer, but they're going to keep the organization safer, because now we're not going to have a collateral effect and collateral harm that takes place. So just those, and then the third one would be the visitor management processes. What is our process going to be for when we have visitors show up to check them in? I still see a lot of instances where organizations, they have somebody at the reception area, they'll come in and they have them sign in as in the reception log, but there's no way to validate and confirm that that person is who they say they are. So having some sort of government issued ID where they show it along with the sign-in process to confirm that, hey, we know who we're talking to here. So those three areas are examples of administrative controls that we recommend, and but we don't see very often.
That's awesome. That definitely a lot of great input. You know, another thing I thought was interesting, I don't know this would go under administrative controls. This is more of a reactive, first aid type situation. But one of the things that I've noticed a lot in the last several years in particular is the presence of stop the bleed kits. You know, whereas in the past you would have, a lot of times you have a basic first aid kit, maybe like an ANSI Class A or Class B kit. And then of course you have your access to 911 or EMS or whatnot. The thing that I thought was really interesting was with the stop the bleed kits is basically, to compare it, I guess, when AEDs started coming around into all the, public spaces, it became that the risk of there being a cardiac event in a public area became so high that it was worth it for organizations and public facilities to put AEDs for ready for use on the wall. And so the message I took from that was that we're now at a point, as a society, that the risk of a active shooter event is high enough that there's a potential that even when the EMS arrives, they won't be able to physically carry enough, pressure bandages and tourniquets to control the bleeding that's needed. And so the risk is high enough to where those are made available to the general public at all times now. What are y'all's thoughts on that? Do you feel like that's a necessary thing? Do you think that we're kind of at that point where the average citizen needs to know how to put on a tourniquet?
Absolutely. It doesn't take much training. Mm-hmm. And really gets back to that idea on how we make those sorts of decisions and commit the resources necessary to make those decisions. And that really comes down to the frequency versus impact. Is it likely to occur? Probably not. But the impact and the consequences of not preparing is so great that we need to have those sorts of resources in place. So we don't just make that decision based on, is this likely to occur? We base it on what would the outcome be if we weren't prepared for that sort of an event. So I agree with you 100% that we need to have those sorts of resources.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, it's definitely an interesting thing, kind of watching how these things evolve over the years. I'm not sure if interesting is the word or scary, but it's certainly things are changing. And that kind of brings us to the last thing, which is personal protective equipment. PPE is an interesting thing also in the same kind of way as stop the bleed kits is that, you know, historically PPE is, you know, we identify the people that are going to be at risk. And then if we can't do anything else to keep them out of danger, then we cover them up in PPE. So in these cases, of course, as you know much better than I do, you know, of course, you've got things like Kevlar helmets and ballistic vests and all kinds of different PPE for people that are expected to be in a situation where they, you know, might be in a gunfight, so to speak. But I've also noticed there's been a lot of things in the last 5-6 years where there's a lot of vendors that are now selling, you know, like ballistic portable ballistic vests you can roll up and put in your backpack or your purse, and all kinds of different types of PPE accessories, so to speak. Do you think there's a place for that type of thing outside of the professional responder and a need for it?
Yeah, for those that can afford to purchase that sort of thing. I mean, again, we're talking about low frequency but high impact, so that sort of PPE would be nice. I know for schools, I've seen the Kevlar backpacks for kids. I've seen Kevlar notebooks.
Wow.
You name it. There's lots of things that, like you said, vendors that are marketing that sort of thing. As far as PPE, I would include purpose-designed lockdown devices in that. You know, you don't need those sorts of devices if we can prevent access, prevent the attacker from getting to the immediate area that you're at. So I would much rather have that. You can't have that Kevlar from head to toe. You can only have it over your torso area. And you still have some very vulnerable areas that are still open to be harmed, even if you had that. So just to prevent access to the attacker altogether into your work area or into the room that you find yourself in via a purpose designed device would be fall into that category too, I think.
Cool. Yeah, thank you. Definitely. Yeah, it's a lot of these new developments. It's quite a thing to see. So the next step, you know, of course, in this place, we put the controls in place, and then we're able to ideally, you know, better prepare and respond. So for the actual response, I know you mentioned this earlier with you know, the potential vulnerabilities of the run, hide, fight, you know, linear model. So when we're talking about training and how to respond to these sorts of things, what are your thoughts on that? As far as the run, hide, fight situation, the concept of patient abandonment, being able to live through this sort of thing. What are your thoughts on necessary training?
Well, we break down what we recommend training-wise into two categories. The first is what training can we provide the organization with, whether that's at the employee level or the leadership level, that would be prevention-based. And examples of that training might be conflict management and de-escalation training, and also behavior threat assessment. People within the organization have been trained how to do a behavior threat assessment. And then that gets into the other type of training, the response-based training that you just referred to there. And that could be the active shooter response. Training. If you're going to get training on active shooter response, we highly recommend that whatever model you're training on, that it's a non-linear based model. What that means is it's not that you use three steps in a particular order. I know when run, hide, fight first came out, they said you run away from the threat if you can. If that doesn't work, then you hide. And if that doesn't work, you fight. Linear based models we have found aren't nearly as effective as non-linear based model. Our model, the three out model, lockout, get out, take out, is a non-linear based model. And which out is right for you is based on one of two things. One, what is your location in relation to the threat? And two, what environment do you find yourself in at the time you perceive the threat? That's what's going to allow you to determine which out is appropriate, lockout, get out, or take out. And so that non-linear. The other response based training that we recommend relates to your PPP or PPE argument and recommendation, and that would be the crisis casualty care training or the stop the bleed training that you talked about. Somebody does get critically injured. How are we going to stop an arterial bleed and or plug a hole or get an airway, those sorts of things? So having those sorts of trainings for at least select people. You don't need them for everybody on some of those topics of training, but at least select people, that would be important.
Great. Yeah, definitely. It's interesting how you mentioned that as well. We were actually just having that conversation a couple of days ago where we were doing a first aid, excuse me, hands-on skills course, and we were talking about the situation that happened, sadly, again here in Houston. This was on Halloween, where the musician Takeoff had gotten shot. He was murdered, and mm-hmm. There was a nurse that had made the scene, and there were a lot of people questioning why she wasn't doing CPR. And what she kept explaining was that because he had a gunshot wound in his neck, if she was doing CPR, it was just going to push more blood out of the gunshot wound. And so they were trying to control the bleeding, which would enable them to do to keep him alive. Sure. So it's interesting. A lot of times, you know, without at least, you know, kind of a cursory level of education on those types of things, people can kind of get the wrong idea, and you might be trying to do CPR and just the person's bleeding out faster.
Yeah. It's an example or difference between some people say doing something is better than doing nothing. Well, that's an example of doing the wrong something is worse than doing nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely a lot of factors there. So yeah, definitely appreciate your perspective on that. You know, it's good to have that level of education and people that have that, I don't know if assignment's the word for it, but they've taken that kind of responsibility.
Yeah. All
right. Cool. Well, that kind of brings us to the last part of the equation. You know, so in the terms of the safety management cycle, we've got, you know, the analysis. Well, of course, first we got to get the subject matter experts together. So again, we appreciate you being here. And we look at the hazards and threats, and then we figure out what we can do to prevent it, ideally. Then if there's any gaps, we try to fill those. Then we follow up on any negative outcomes and figure out how we can improve and, you know, mitigate the situation. And then, of course, then we check how we're doing and we do the cycle again. So in terms of this type of thing, outside of course, you know, horrific incidents, what are some different metrics that you can speak to that might be good for organizations to think about, things that they can kind of benchmark and see how they're doing internally?
Yeah, safety related topics, slips, trips, falls, cuts, forklift safety, all those sorts of things, those are easier to assign metrics to. Mm-hmm. And typically in our world, when we talk safety related issues, those are usually natural hazards with no ill intent. But security-related issues, we usually refer to those as man-made hazards with somebody with malice and forethought. So on the security side of preparedness, it's difficult to measure our success because the historical data, it just isn't there because of the infrequency of these types of events, even though they're super high-impact events. So it's hard to measure what doesn't happen as a result of training or otherwise. So a couple other ways that we've developed measurements or metrics on this is, you know, one of the objections to training people on the workplace violence active threat topic is, well, we don't want to train people because that'll scare people. Well, one of the metrics that we talk about is that really shows a fundamental misunderstanding of the origin of fear. Fear comes from having a problem without a solution. And so what happens through training is now we're giving them a solution to their problem. If we just came in and told them that it's getting worse and we didn't give them a solution to that problem, yeah, that could increase fear. So we could have a metric where if we talk about morale and productivity, I would like to have a metric where we measure through a survey tool of some sort, how fearful are people on this topic prior to training, 1 to 5, versus how fearful people are on this topic after training, 1 to 5. That would be one way to measure and have some metrics. Then another question that might be asked in a tool like that, a 1 to 5 scoring tool, would be how well prepared do they feel prior to the training versus after the training? And then the third question might be, what portion of the training do you think was the most beneficial for the employee or the end user? whether it's the scenario piece, whether it's the classroom instruction, whether it's the video instruction, whether it's the technique and principle practice and demonstrations and Q&A. And now that will allow us to continue to improve that training process and deliver a better product overall and really get a good measurement on how people feel on that particular topic versus being very fearful on the topic absence training.
Yeah, that's great. That's definitely good. That's it, you know, it provides a proactive measurement and it measures perception. So you can tell where, mm-hmm. how the knowledge, you know, skills and abilities tie to their capability, I guess is the word. So yeah, that's fantastic. I hadn't thought of that. That's great. Cool. Well, yeah, that pretty much brings us through the cycle there, you know, so, definitely a lot of fantastic input there. There's, you know, such a volatile, you know, scary situation. So to your point, you know, the more knowledge, the more resources, the more abilities, the better off everybody is. Yeah, that's awesome. We're certainly glad to have you here today. And your webinars have all been fantastic. Of course, you got great feedback. So we're always appreciative.
Thank you so much.
Certainly. Is there anything else you'd like to add today? Anything that maybe I didn't mention or anything you want to plug?
Yeah, we have an e-learning product called Prevail. And one of the reasons we named it Prevail is, you know, you can do everything wrong and still survive an incident like this. That's not the goal, is to survive it. The goal is to prevail with through the incident. And my definition of prevail is I'm going home the same amount of holes I came with. So we have an e-learning product that we recommend to people that are wanting to test it out. We give free trials out for that. If they wanted to go to our website, check that out. The strategosintl.com/prevail, they could check that out. We'd actually set them up with a free trial login, so they could take the course themselves if they're a decision maker. And, you know, knowing that this is a scary topic that we're talking about, I just want to tell people the importance of being prepared, but at the same time, tell them I hope that everything they learned today was a complete waste of time and it's never needed.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely the hope. Nobody has to deal with these sorts of things. You know, speaking of which, if you've got another minute, you just brought this to mind as you talked about, you know, being able to if faced with something like this, you know, not only live through it, but come out the other side. What are your thoughts on the post incident side as far as recovery, critical incident stress debriefings, mental health support, faith based support? Any thoughts on that? Best practices? Anything that comes to mind?
Well, you know, we kind of stay away from that phrase best practices. And we do that for a legal reason. We do a lot of expert witness. What you don't want is another expert on the other side of the courtroom boxing you in and say, well, that's not a best practice. This is the best practice. So we use the phrase leading practices instead. So you really don't get boxed in as much there. But as far as the post-incident side, yeah, the reunification processes, the business continuity, what are those leading practices? What should they be? The debriefing and getting those folks the mental health assistance that they're going to need, people that have gone through the incidents like this. There's going to be a lot of incidents of PTSD. So we got to have employee assistance programs set up ahead of time where those people will have those sorts of resources to get that kind of help. That's not something we specialize in. There's a lot of organizations that are very professional and much more competent in those areas than we are. But yeah, we definitely know there's a tremendous need and a high importance of doing that within your organization and doing it prior to the incident, not waiting until game day when it's too late.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely great input. And that there's been a lot of that in the last year in particular, you know, coming out of the the pandemic and all different types of situations, the mental health first aid and a lot of different resources in that area. So that's great. Definitely a need for it. All right. Well, heck, I know you're very busy. I don't want to take up your whole day, but again, we sure appreciate you being here on behalf of ASSP, Healthcare Practice Specialty, and AOHP, and everybody in it. You know, you're certainly valued and appreciated. For everybody listening, if you haven't checked it out, we have about 45 episodes up now. We're on anchor.fm/ASSP-HCPS-HealthBeat, and that's the HealthBeat podcast. Then the AOHP podcast is anchor.fm/AOHP. And in both cases, you're going to find a lot of fantastic speakers, a lot of different topics, a lot of great information up to and including Vaughn Baker today. So check that out. We got some webinars coming up. If you haven't seen those, they're on the AOHP.org site or the ASSP Healthcare Practice Specialty site. Healthcare Practice Specialty, we have a panel coming up, which is going to have a panel discussion on best practices, right? Leading practices, thank you, between the Blacks in Safety Excellence and the Hispanic Safety Professionals groups. So we're going to have a lot of good conversations there about safety management, safety leadership, and AOHP. We have several different topics coming up in the next few months. And then, of course, the call for speakers is open for AOHP as well for the national conference, which will be in September in Savannah, Georgia. But for now, we'll go ahead and wrap it up, and we hope to see everybody real soon. Vaughn, thank you again for being here. We sure appreciate you.
Thank you, Corey. Appreciate it.